Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Sarah L. Warner. Warner is a faculty fellow at Harvard's Charles Warren Center for Studies in American History and an associate professor in the Department of Performing and Media Arts at Cornell University. She is also a core member of the Feminist Gender and Sexuality Studies Program and the Lesbian, Bisexual, and Gay Studies Program, also at Cornell. Her first book, which will be the focus of this interview, is called Acts of Gaiety, LGBT Performance and the Politics of Pleasure. Acts of Gaiety received the 2013 Outstanding Book Award for Theater Studies and was a finalist for the 2013 Lambda Literary Award. Acts of Gaiety was published by the University of Michigan Press. And welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
This book totally fascinated me. Now, I want to talk about the fact that Acts of Gaiety explores some of the playful methods of social and political activism in the LGBT communities, especially in the 60s and 70s. But prior to that, you know, organizations were trying to get people to assimilate more. So let's talk about that.
Are you referring specifically to groups like the Mattachine Society?
Yeah, and Daughters of Bilitis.
Bilitis, exactly, yeah, uh-huh. Who formed just shortly after their incorporation. Indeed, I mean, I think it was about respectability, and it was about assimilation. And, you know, they are the forerunners of the modern gay and lesbian movement, and we owe them a lot.
Yes.
Indeed, and their history should be celebrated, but, you know, their tactics were quite different than those 60s radicals.
Uh-huh. And you suggest that the Stonewall Uprising in 1969 was the beginning of gaiety, which is the term you use for the whole theme of this book. To tell us what you mean by that.
I think that it consolidated strands of gaiety that were going on in the gay and lesbian community, because at the same time there was the Mattachine Society and the Daughters of Bilitis that were a little more sober in their politics, in their desire to be taken seriously by mainstream society. There were these countercurrents in the 50s in African-American communities. In fact, those date all the way back to the 20s with the mm-hmm. Cotton Club and things like that. Lots of queer gaiety going on in those places, and also avant-garde circles with Allen Ginsberg and people like Jill Johnston and Fluxus. So I think there were strands of gaiety, but they were more artistic, perhaps, than mm-hmm. political.
And
I think
to tell us what you mean by gaiety. I mean, you use it as a political term, a social term.
I use it as a term to denote mirthful acts of social dissent that draw attention to one's sexuality, that kind of flaunt it in a flamboyant way, and that really stress the joy and jubilation, right, of sexual intimacy, of alternative kinship structures, and that it is in some sense the exact opposite of what the folks like DOB and Mattachine were doing, to say we're not like everybody else. Uh-huh. We don't want to be like everybody uh-huh. else. In fact, what we offer is something, you know, and quite distinct, and is about pleasure and how politics and pleasure and performance are all intimately related.
I thought it was a very interesting way of thinking about it. Let's talk about zaps. You talked about zap actions, which I found really interesting, and you particularly brought up, the first one you brought up was in 1970 at a NOW meeting. Lesbians were being excluded, not invited, told to act straight. Tell us about the zaps.
Yeah, I start the book with recounting the Lavender Menace zap. And this was at the second Congress to Unite Women in 1970. And for the second year in a row, lesbians had been excluded, actively excluded from the program. And, you know, by this time, there had been some consciousness raising about lesbian issues. And it was soon to radically divide now. And this was really the kind of catalyzing event. And a group of women, Rita Mae Brown, Carla Jay, and other folks, Martha Shelley, they were from a variety of different organizations, came together for this action, and they planted themselves in the audience, killed the lights, and people started to get a little nervous. And when they flipped the lights on, there were a group of women standing on stage in Lavender Menace t-shirts. And this is what Betty Friedan had called lesbians. They were a Lavender Menace that threatened the women's movement. And then they started a kind of call and response with people who were planted in the audience, and then they raised their hand and started stripping and revealing their t-shirts underneath and running up to the podium. And then it sort of ended with a call for, you know, anyone who was a lesbian or was in solidarity with lesbians and thought that they should have a place in the movement to come up. And a bevy of women who had nothing to do with the action came up, and it was humorous, it was playful, it was seductive. And it really showcased that lesbians weren't the problem.
Yeah.
Their presence wasn't their problem. The absence of lesbians was the problem.
Yeah. And I love that way of getting rid of the fear that so many women had about lesbians. And that went on for a long time in Now Chapters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I have a history of being part of a couple Now Chapters.
Me too.
And I remember how they used to tell people to dress right and look right and don't cause any problems. And
that's just like the Daughters of Bilitis,
yeah,
where women couldn't wear pants to meetings. And, you know, you had to act a certain way. And then they've rarely, if ever, mentioned the word lesbians at these meetings. I mean, again, it's about thinking that the way you're going to attain social justice or be accepted by society is to be, you know, quite serious and sober and act as if you were just like everyone else.
Yeah, and a lot of us equated it with acting like a Stepford wife.
Oh, exactly.
Now,
deadly.
I know. You talk about in the 70s when the LGBT community took back the word queer, which was always used as a derogatory, you know, throughout the straight culture at least. So, tell us about that. Tell us about the evolution of the word queer. It became some kind of a power symbol in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Activists in the wake of the Stonewall riot claimed the word gay, and they were building on Black is Beautiful, and so their slogan was Gay is Good. And it was a response to really medical and legal authorities using homosexual and in related terms as a kind of diagnosis, as a stigma. So gay was a term that was about self-identification. And it was also, you know, showing that it's not bad or shameful to be gay, that it is, in fact, good and you know, rather happy. And then, you know, like all things radical, it became kind of commodified. And the notion of gay pride really had more to do eventually with shopping habits and consumer lifestyle than it did with a form of radical politics. And you couple this with the kind of slow devolution of the term with the AIDS crisis, and it calls for a new political strategy. And so at this moment, the word queer emerges almost simultaneously in activist circles and academic circles. And a lot of people were, of course, participating in both. And, you know, queer announced itself as this radical, aggressive, in-your-face term that was both an affront to straight society and the apathy, in particular dealing with AIDS as a crisis, but also to earlier generations of activists, whereas this kind of, you know, happy-go-lucky notion of gay pride really wasn't what was going to help people in this AIDS crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a very, at the time, I think it was, you know, and I came out in San Francisco right about this time, sort of, you know, coming out as a lesbian, but coming out into this political moment. And it was a powerful term about anti-normativity and about really addressing phobic policies and structural inequalities. But I think, again, like every other term, it too became commodified, and queers actively sought out the media, and Grand Fury in particular, Silence Equals Death, and these kinds of things.
Oh, yeah.
You know, a lot of advertisers and marketing guys were part of ACT UP. And so it's not surprising that within a few years we go from Silence Equals Death to Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, which is a show about shopping. And my other issue with queer is that it really, I think, occluded, and this is what I try to make the case for in my book, is that it borrowed so much from feminism and lesbian feminism in particular, but that borrowing has been just absolutely obscured by the rhetoric and by the action. And not only did it take without crediting feminism, but it also then wanted to cast feminism and lesbian feminism as this kind of essentialist, dowdy, dogmatic, kind
humorless.
Of humorless, killjoy sort of movement. And of course there were people like that, but I don't think that in any way characterizes the movement. And so what I try to get at in unearthing this term gayety and analyzing it is to recover what has been lost in this moment, right? Mm-hmm. And to look in particular at acts of gayety by lesbian feminists at earlier moments in history.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people have never heard of some of this stuff.
Most of it probably.
Yeah, they probably don't. Well, a lot of gayety has been co-opted by this need to assimilate and look like straight community. And talk to us about the fact that in the earlier days, a lot of lesbian feminists were totally opposed to marriage.
Oh, yeah, I think.
And that has the thing that has really come full circle for some people. I mean,
I think that we could say that it's a case of cultural amnesia. No one talks about lesbian feminist objection to marriage or even straight women's objection to marriage in the 70s. And that I make that the subject of an entire chapter in the book. And I, you know, I call the current fascination with marriage a husbandly approach to the topic, because it's not that there weren't women who were advocating at any time in history for marriage, but by and large, lesbian feminists were deeply opposed to this patriarchal institution, and they, you know, they looked at it from gender oppression, but also from class oppression. And I take us through a number of Zap actions, including the first bridal fair action by a group called WITCH, Women's International Terrorist Conspiracy from Hell. I love saying that name.
I love that name.
And they picketed the first bridal fair exhibit at Madison Square Garden in 1969. And, you know, they really peeled back the layers of the onion there to reveal just how deeply imbricated it was, not only with patriarchal society, but with these imperialist projects. For example, one of the largest makers of wedding dresses also had contracts to make the coffins for the flags that they draped over the servicemen's coffins as they came back from Vietnam, right? Or that it was also sponsored by food and beverage vendors that were had ties to the Banana Republic in South America. Mm-hmm. Or that the banks, J.P. Morgan and Chase in particular, you know, were trying to sell people not only mortgages, but also, you know, all these brand new spanking make our life better appliances on credit. And so they brought all of this to the surface through this fabulous displays of saying, here come the slaves off to their graves to the tune of the wedding march. And they made veils of dollar bills, and some dressed as witches, and they hexed the vendors and released cages of white mice on the floor. It, you know, it was a pretty spectacular event, and it built directly on the Miss America protest the year before.
Yeah. When I think back on that, I couldn't remember that whole thing, but then it all came back to me. I remember lesbian feminists equating marriage with slavery and servitude, and so it's remarkable to see what's happening now.
It's remarkable, really, because if you say to someone, as I often do, yes, I feel that people should have the right to get married, but that's not where I want to spend my political capital. That's not the petitions I want to sign. That's not what I want to march for. I mean, it's as if you have uttered the most treasonous, you know, response, and that you're somehow against liberation for gays and lesbians. And I think, on the contrary, I think there's not enough conversation about the ways in which marriage and military service, which is the other issue that dominates the contemporary gay agenda, are the two things in particular that activists in the 60s were absolutely against. You know, so, you know, to what extent are those markers of equality and liberation, and to what extent is it really just us tied, you know, tethered completely to the nation state and to things that oppress us all?
Yeah. I mean, you said I've watched many aspects of the LGBT movement go from like a freedom agenda to an almost a right-wing agenda, family values kind of agenda, which is remarkable too. Why do you think that has happened?
Well, I think that there are many reasons for that. One is that I think, you know, people want what they think and what is marketed to them as the good life. And, you know, who doesn't want to be comfortable, and who doesn't want to feel safe and secure and be loved by everyone? So I think that, you know, there's just kind of a general inertia. And, you know, not everyone sees assimilation as bad. Not everyone sees moving into the mainstream as bad. You know, I think where we've come back to is a kind of 50s politics, not a 60s politics. Mm. I think it's absolutely what Mattachine and DOB were striving for. But then we have to ask who benefits from that. And it's the people who already have some modicum of social privilege, right? It's usually not the most economically depressed. It's usually not people of color or sex workers or transgender people who are benefiting from these, you know, mainstream agenda items. It's, you know, middle class people of a certain kind of privilege. And it's just, you know, and it doesn't do anything for other groups. That's the other thing. It's not part of a broader liberation agenda. It's simply about gaining additional rights. And even the recent Supreme Court cases are, it's about tax breaks, and it's about children. And that's the other thing. I mean, you know, lesbians have always had children. Gay men have always had children. Mm-hmm. But now there's this emphasis on that's the justification for marriage in most cases. It's like, it's what's in the best interest of the children. And this puts us, whether we want to admit it or not, firmly in bed with the quote-unquote Family Values Coalition, who are always arguing for the safety of society based on the benefit of children.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sarah L. Warner. We're talking about her book, Acts of Gaiety, LGBT Performance and the Politics of Pleasure. You came up with a term called homo liberalism, and I find that really quite a fascinating term. So tell us what you mean by that.
Homo liberalism is the term I use to describe a sexual neoliberalism, or the kind of neoliberalization of sexual politics, meaning a slow but steady turn to a conservative ideology, one that's rooted not in liberation or not in necessarily parity or equality, but a kind of consumer citizenship where we believe that, you know, rights should be granted based on economic issues. It's an economic program for social inclusion that does not really in any significant way restructure society, think about the redistribution of wealth, or work necessarily in terms of a coalition with other groups who are marginalized or excluded mm-hmm. from these rights and privileges. You know, for me, that's, I think, what's wrong with contemporary politics. And it's part of a much larger economic phenomenon that far exceeds sexual politics, but racial politics that are rooted in neoliberalism. And you saw this, you know, in recent elections, right, where or even in the first Proposition 8 case, where the conservative vote is targeting racial minorities because, you know, what they have in common is this particular ideology. But you have quote-unquote liberals or, you know, mainstream also trying those same tactics. It's in some ways, it's really hard to tell the liberals from the conservative, yeah, despite the political rhetoric.
That's true. Do you think it's because some of the older guard got tired of being political and tired of being activists, and then some of the younger generations sort of wanted to settle into a normal life and didn't really want to be political? What do you make of that?
That's interesting. I think these things always go in waves. I mean, if we look at feminism back, you know, to the first wave, we can certainly see how there are generations of, you know, or there are moments rather of activity and energy and then fallow periods, and then something will happen and it will reactivate. And I think it also had a lot to do with the fact that a lot of really radical activists died because of the AIDS epidemic, yeah, or they died because of breast cancer, or history wasn't documented properly.
Especially women's history.
Especially
women's history is not being documented.
Yeah, and I think things like feminism have never overcome the stigma of the word. You know, lots of my students believe they're post-label, and they believe that feminism is a silly word or it's a dirty word, and yeah, it's not something that they want to identify with.
Yeah. Oh, God. Well, you also talk about the desire for, you know, social acceptance that has made some members of the LBG community, and this was happening before, police themselves. You know, non-threatening images and still, you know, being told to look straight in many ways.
Well, and I think
the Human Rights Campaign is a pretty conservative organization.
Yeah, and we just acquired at Cornell the papers for the HRC. So at some point, I really look forward to diving into them, because it would be interesting for me, you know, in terms of my own research, to trace, see really just how much of a role HRC played in the neoliberalization of sexual politics. And I mean, they're an interesting case, because in previous generations, activists were not paid. It was grassroots. Mm-hmm. It was a labor of love. And
now, it was a matter of life and death.
It was
too.
A matter of life and death.
People were desperate to be able to live their lives and be safe and not be afraid all the time.
Right. And HRC is populated by people who, you know, are paid employees. They don't necessarily have a history of activism. It's certainly not from a grassroots ground up perspective. And what they have are lots and lots of wealthy board members. I mean, you can't imagine the Gay Liberation Front having a wealthy board of donors.
Yeah.
And marriage was always HRC's agenda, and they really focused on little else. I mean, they have immigration to a certain extent, adoption, hospital visitation, but they have focused almost exclusively on marriage.
Yeah. You suggest that it's the pride agenda that's disarticulated us from the gayety agenda. To tell us a little bit more about that. I mean, do you think there can be both, or has the pride agenda really taken over real activist politics, do you think?
You know, it's interesting, because the first parade was the Christopher Street Liberation Day, you know, affair, and it wasn't a pride parade at all. Pride gets attached a little bit later. And I think pride is an important element. It led to the foundation of gay and lesbian studies across campuses. It led to the creation of gay and lesbian bookstores. It was a
many
powerful...
Many of which do not survive to
most
this
of which have not
yeah,
survived
absolutely
today.
Absolutely not, yeah.
Thank you, Barnes & Noble and Amazon. I mean, in one hand, it's fantastic that such a wealth of gay materials are available everywhere.
And the materials have been assimilated.
But the materials have been assimilated, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
they don't necessarily stock them on the shelves. If you go to our local Ithaca Barnes & Noble, the gay and lesbian section is incredibly tiny. It's there, but it's tiny. So they may have assimilated it, but what's actually available is another thing.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of LGBT material is out of print, too.
Which
is also a part of the case.
It is out of print.
Let's talk about the women's music scene that sort of cropped up, too, with Olivia Records and women's forging their own worlds and agendas. We thought that would change the world.
Yeah.
And to talk to us a little bit about how radical it really was.
That's not a period of the women's movement that I personally lived through. I was born a little bit later than that, but I certainly grew up listening to that music, and my media room wall is you know, papered with album covers. And folks did think that would change the world, and it was about creating an alternative sphere of production and consumption that was not tied to capitalist or imperialist projects to the extent that was possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was about training women for fields that they had been excluded from, and creating alternative kinship systems, alternative currency systems, and about creating women's public space, which there, you know, is always a dearth of. And folks did think it would change the world, and in some ways it did.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't have an Ani DiFranco if you don't have Olivia Records.
That's right, that's right. And it also, you know, I've had so many people on my show who, Janice Ian, and it gave people a precedent for starting their own companies.
It
and
did.
That was revolutionary.
It did.
When Holly Near did that, and Chris Williamson, that wonderful first album, The Changer and the Changed.
Oh, yeah.
I had Holly on the show. I've had June Millington on. You know,
oh,
all those great
yeah,
people.
Fanny.
They're still producing.
They are still producing.
So they are still being revolutionaries in a smaller world, I suppose.
And Janice Ian was the featured entertainer at the Lambda Awards this year, and I just saw Holly Near at Joe's Pub. So, yes, they are still very much active. You know, it's kind of complicated because the women's music scene in particular is demonized, I think, by queer politics as absolutely essential, as transphobic, as, you know, replicating in many ways the very structures that they sought to critique. It's not quite as ethnically diverse as anyone would want, you know, and these kinds of things. And those things are true, but that doesn't mean there weren't radical and revolutionary things that came out of it at the same time. I do think that it's been slow to evolve on things like issues of trans inclusion. I will say that.
That's slowly starting to happen. Very, very slowly.
Very slow and very and reluctantly, as you know.
Yeah.
But the very first sign interpreters of a concert were at the Women's Michigan Music Festival, and now it's everywhere you go.
I remember how revolutionary that was. Even small concerts I used to go to, there would be signers, yeah.
Right, and just to be, you know, I think it's hard, especially for very, very young queers or very, very young feminists, to imagine a world where to get that many women in a room together and to get them together and be out about their sexuality or politics was so utterly taboo. I think it is easy, in retrospect, to dismiss the urgency, immediacy, and political import that those kind of gatherings had. You know, when you have, you know, 700 acres of land in Hart, Michigan, and you have this gathering of women, that was revolutionary.
Oh, yeah.
Did it evolve? No, but I think it's also because it's a once-a-year kind of venue, or, you know, because then it was Olivia Records was over here, and then they got into the cruise business, which is a kind of curious business to get into, and,
but I think a lot of people came away from those politicized, and they went back to their communities.
Absolutely, they did,
and
energized.
And so in that way, they made an effect, you know, and in that way, it did empower and help to change the world. So where we come to this moment with, let's talk about Prop 8.
Yeah.
You talk about how, you know, most of the radical groups were gone by then. ACT UP,
yeah.
Queer Nation, they were all gone by then. Talk to us about what your feelings are about Prop 8 and the fight for gay marriage in California especially.
You know, again, I'm really conflicted on the issue of marriage. I think that, of course, it should absolutely be a right. But what I'm interested in tracing in the book is how marriage came to be the cornerstone of the gay agenda. And I think it's through the kinds of conservative impulses, but also the need, the real, very real and urgent need during the AIDS crisis for people to have visitation rights, for them to be able to maintain their apartment after their lover died because they weren't on the lease, you know, to have access to bank accounts for shared accounts. But families came in and just dispensed with all these other forms of intimacy.
That's what younger LGBT people don't understand.
Yeah.
How heartbreaking the AIDS epidemic was when it first started.
Devastating.
Lovers couldn't go in to see their dying lovers.
Nope.
Families would take away all their possessions. Oh, it was heartbreaking.
It was heartbreaking. And so, you know, looking for sometimes quick and expedient fixes to that, I think sometimes we made some choices that perhaps now people in more progressive circles regret, because it did kind of pave the way for, well, if we just get married, then all of that stuff will be taken care of. And what that does is then overlooks sort of all of the problems that marriage can't solve, or,
exactly,
you know, that all of the problems that we then inherit if marriage becomes our solution to these problems.
Yeah. And we stop challenging the status quo,
too.
We still have Matthew Shepard's and kids committing suicide, and marriage is not going to stop people from hating.
No, marriage is. And if anything, I think what we can expect is a swift and prompt backlash, in the same way that we saw in Roe v. Wade. I mean, we're still experiencing the backlash from that kind of legislation.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I do think it needs to be a federal amendment, I think this going state by states on marriage is not going to work. I think that there's some reluctance to do it until there's more support from more states, because to put it up and have it fail, or to put it up and have the kind of backlash that Roe v. Wade had, I think would be kind of dangerous.
Mm.
But it's not going to change until it's a federal amendment. And then maybe my fantasy is, I think it might be a naive fantasy, but then if we take care of marriage, then we can get back to a more progressive agenda.
Mm.
But, you know, maybe then, you know, I think what my fear is, if that's my hope, my fear is that we will just become very complacent, and it will be like, oh, of course, we're equal now. We can all get married, and case closed, politics over, game done. That, I think, is a very real fear, and one I hope doesn't come to pass.
Yeah. Well, what else do you think might happen in the future from this?
Prop 8?
Yeah, or from the gay marriage push and the running away sort of from fighting the status quo and inequality and, you know, economic inequality. I mean, we're not talking about any of that.
Well, no,
and
I think immigration is an issue that gets tacked on. And then again, I think the answer to immigration is going to be, oh, well, you must get married. And I think what we're going to see is an erosion of things like domestic partnership. And you're going to be forced to get married, even if that's not your politics, to retain the benefits you fought so hard for in an earlier incarnation. And I think that I'm going to be very angry if I feel like I'm pushed to that point, because I'm a supporter of domestic partnerships and civil unions and other kinds of arrangements mm-hmm. that create different kinds of family structures and different kinds of bonds. I think we're going to see a rush to massive bridezilla, groomzilla weddings to make up for all of those years that we couldn't get married. But I also think people will be shocked and surprised at how few people actually take up marriage when push comes to shove.
Mm.
I think some people will take it up and they will do it as big as possible. But I think, you know, I remember reading in the paper after marriage became legal in New York State, they extended the hours in Ithaca, because we do have a sizable gay and lesbian community for a small town, and everybody was waiting, and they got, I think, 13 people the first week, or 13 couples.
Yeah.
Like, we aren't going to flock to it in the way that I think straight society and even some members of the gay community think we're going to flock to it.
Yeah.
I think we want it as a right, because we don't want to be told that we can't have it, and we shouldn't be told that we can't have it. But I don't actually think that's the way a lot of gay and lesbian people want to organize their lives and their families.
Yes, I hear a call to politics. We're almost out of time, sir. Can you give some contact information in case people want to get in touch or talk to you about the book?
Sure. I have a Tumblr account for the book, Acts of Gaiety, and I have a website that you can link to from pma.cornell.edu. Just click on my name, and I'd be happy to talk to anyone about gay and lesbian politics.
Great. Well, Sarah L. Warner, thank you so much for joining us. Again, the book is called Acts of Gaiety, LGBT Performance, and the Politics of Pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.